Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. The ambience that you're hearing, the acoustic, is different from our studios on the Gateway campus because I'm recording this morning show in a really magnificent space, a space right in the heart of downtown Kenosha, which I only saw with my own eyes scarcely a week ago. I am in the main auditorium, right in the center of the main auditorium of the Kenosha Theater. And longtime Kenoshans probably know at least something about this spectacular space, which has been essentially closed to the public for decades. But through the tireless efforts of some devoted volunteers, this has been restored to some extent. Not, of course, to its original spectacular grandeur, but at least to some extent preserved from the elements, preserved in the hopes that this beautiful space may someday be more fully restored and used as a performance venue. Joining me here in the heart of the Kenosha Theater is Jeff Bass and Ron Larson, who are two of the people who are most intimately involved in the efforts to preserve this beautiful space. Before we start talking about the theater, maybe we can get a little word about each of you, the role that you have played. Jeff, you actually sort of hold the keys to this space, don't you?
Yes, I do. My family and a friend bought it in 1983. At that time, we thought we could rally the community around us and get it done just in a matter of, you know, not days, but we thought it wouldn't take that long. But things turned out what they were. But yeah, it's 1983. My brother and I are really the only people that are left to basically caretake it, along with the board for the theater. The building has 12 apartments, and that's where my brother and I are basically landlords to take care of that. But the rents from the apartments are what's basically preserving this building, making it able to pay its taxes and to do repairs to keep it viable, what we call securing the envelope. You know?
Right. So you and your brother are the owners of this building, then?
Yes, but, well, that's who it is right now. So and then we lease it. We gave a long term lease to the 501c3 not for profit Kenosha Theater Restoration Project, and I'm also the chairman of that, and Ron is the vice president.
Ron Larson, who's also with us. At what point did you come on board on this effort?
Right. I'm a Kenosha native, born and raised here, and I moved away, and I lived in California for many years. I came back in 2007, and that's when I got involved. You know, born and raised in Kenosha, I'd never even heard of the Kenosha Theater. Huh. And then I learned about it when I came back and just fell in love with it. And so I've been involved since then. I'm the new blood.
So this theater was essentially already closed at the time that you were growing up here?
Well, yeah, theater closed in 1963. I was born in 63. So, yeah, it was closed. It's been closed my entire life.
Let's find out something about its history. I know, Jeff, I guess you're the one that we turn to find out something about when this building was first built and to what extent it is, even then in its heyday when there were all kinds of movie houses like this, how it was something truly distinctive, even back in that era.
Well, it was built in 1927 by Universal Studio, or for Universal Studios, by L.P. Larson was the architect, but the guy who commissioned it was Carl Lemley, and who was the founder of Universal Studios. And back in the day of when movies were young, and there's a whole history of you know, theater or movie history. There was the group called the Independents, and he was in New York for a while, and he was called the Little Giant from Kenosha. And he ended up being the founder of Universal Studios. But so, and when Universal Studios got large enough, and when the whole movie thing, where they would actually control creating the movie, and then they'd own all the movie theaters. So they actually owned it from beginning to end, which ended up with an antitrust lawsuit that was back later. But anyways, so Universal Studios was building fine holdings like this all around the country. But this was the finest one because it was where Carl Emley was from, Wisconsin, and this was considered the gateway to his home state. So he put one of the finest holdings that Universal had. And this theater actually hosted some world premieres. The second talking picture ever made, or the first fully talking picture ever made by Universal Studios, had its premiere here.
What film was that?
It was called Melody of Love. I can't remember the names of. It was like, I think it was like Walter Pigeon, and I can't remember.
So jazz singer, of course, is what we always think of. But as you're alluding to, that film is only partially talking. Some of it is silent. But it was still what put sound movies on the map. And
right.
So the one that comes right after it has its first screening here.
Yep, that's it, The Melody of Love. Now, the jazz singer screened here also. So it was the very first talking picture. And when we were doing the research, we found that Carl Emley actually went to and borrowed the movie tone equipment, the same equipment that they used to make The Jazz Singer, and for Universal Pictures. But now we've went looking to find prints of The Melody of Love have been lost to history.
That's a movie that's vanished.
Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of them have. Wow. So
remind me, the year that this theater, the Kenosha Theater, opened was what?
It opened August 31st, 1927. There's actually a Kenosha Theater edition of the Kenosha News at that time. And it's wonderful. The pictures of it and the explanations are just fabulous.
Now, one of the things you mentioned the other day when I toured this space for the first time was that this was not only a place where movies were shown, but also where live entertainment occurred on that very screen, on that stage. Was this common back in that era for a place like this to be used for both movies and live entertainment? And would it have that dual purpose right from the start, or is that something that only happened later?
Oh, it was a vaudeville house right from the start. It would be. It opened. It used to have five big acts, and then a photo feature, they called it. So it was always, intended to be a vaudeville house.
So in one night, in a given evening, someone would experience both. It's not just one night we're going to show a movie, the next night we'll have animal acts. One and the same, both would happen in the course of a single evening.
Yep, in the same evening, you'd see five vaudeville acts, and then you'd see a movie.
And it's interesting that you mentioned animal acts, because like we showed you on the tour, on stage there are six, three on each side of animal tie-down rings. So these metal rings affixed to the floor of the stage, which is where you would tie up, live animals that were going to go on stage.
It's been known that Harry Blackstone made an elephant disappear off the stage of the Kenosha Theater. There's a lot of famous names of the time. A lot of people might not know some of them, but a lot of names of the time certainly came to the Kenosha Theater. It was one of the places that you played in the circuit.
And later on, near the end, so this, again, it was built in 27, so all through the 30s you had, that going on. And we have a poster, or the photocopy of a poster, 1954, of the Three Stooges performing here. You know what I mean? So well into the 50s you had live acts performing here.
For sure.
And that was with Shemp, I believe.
Yeah, that was with Shemp. We also had a lot of big bands.
Harry James,
Dick Juergens, a lot of people knew who that was. Lawrence Welk was here. So there's quite a Chico Marx came here. The Tommy Dorsey's orchestra, and at the time Frank Sinatra was the singer. So you look, when you think about the names that have performed on the stage, there's a, we should actually have a ghost light, for.
Wow. So do we know very much? I mean, you've told us about a couple of the films that were shown. Do we have records that tell us exactly what movies were shown here and when they were shown? I mean, I think some people would be curious to know how that would even work back then in 1927. Would the same film be shown here weeks at a time, and or one night at a time? How did the scheduling work back then?
Actually, we had a volunteer, Bill Betcher, who recently passed. He passed this last November. He was our archivist, and he was phenomenal. We have in possession binders of every ad that ever ran for the Kenosha Theater from the time it opened to the time it closed.
Wow.
And he's also scanned them all, and he also has them listed in a numerical fashion, which we're working to get into a database. So online you'll be able to call up a particular date to see what was playing at the Kenosha Theater that day. So I've got all of it done. You know, we were trying to get it done, but then he got sick, and but we're aiming to get it done, for Bill too, because it was one of his pet projects, and he took him years to actually go to the library and scan and look up every document. So it'll be cool when we get it on.
So the record that exists, it's not like records of the office manager or the business people here. It's from the Kenosha News, based on the ads in the Kenosha News.
And so from that we can probably glean what films were shown when.
And how long they ran, and back in those days there were more, this was the major form of entertainment. So films, they changed quite frequently.
I've seen pictures, like somebody would bring a picture of somebody in front of the Kenosha Theater, and we'd say, "Do you know when this could be?" And we could look at what the movie was.
Ah.
And by actually flipping through and say, "What about what year?" And they'd say, 1930s, late 30s, and we would be able to say, well, it would be that movie ran from September 3rd to September 6th, 1943, or whatever. Mm. We could find out. So wow. We could do a little bit of research. We've actually done that for research. We didn't have any pictures of the inside of the building for the longest time. And it was just like about 5 years ago. Somebody said, there's a Life magazine had started digitizing its archives. And it turns out that Life magazine had sent a photographer here who had done this entire photo documentary of the inside of the building and showing kids lining up for a Kenosha News back-to-school special and Myrna or ads for the Myrna Loy, Too Hot to Handle. So for the longest time, we had no photos of what was going on in the Kenosha Theater. Mm. And then at one point, now all of a sudden, we have over 100 photos that aren't just good photos. They're iconic Life magazine photos of the Kenosha Theater, which now is when I look at it and when I look at all of the documentation we've had of the restoration of the theater or the restoration of the apartments, we're probably one of the better documented theaters that are left standing.
So you really have a sense of what this place looked like in its heyday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And when we first purchased the place, the plaster was actually in a lot better shape. Putting the new roof on did a lot of damage to the cast plaster. But when we first came in, I did an entire detailed photo study of it, and we also peeled back a lot of paint to get the original paint job. So we really did a lot of chronicling of what the place was.
And just for the record, that Life photo essay was 1938. I mean, I'm unclear as to whether it was published, but Life, I don't think it was, but the Life photographer came here, did the photos, so they exist in the archives of Life, but I don't think they were ever published in the magazine.
But you can do a Google search for Kenosha Theater, Life magazine, and you'll see just an incredible, just the photos are just great. There's one of the ticket girl at the ticket counter, and it looks like it's like iconic 1930s, it could be a movie poster.
So how many people were seated in this theater when it was open for business?
Well, it's varied what they say. The number has varied over the years to 2,400. Hmm. And when it opened, they were saying 2,400. But as time went on, I think they eliminated some seats in the back for wheelchairs. I mean, as time went on, we didn't really have the ADA, back then.
Right.
So they pulled out some seats in the back. But, we're 2,200 plus. They always advertised a 900-seat balcony. So, and for us, when we were looking at a business plan for a restoration, for a theater that would work in between Milwaukee and Chicago, 2,000 is like the magic number for a lot of the touring acts because then the economics start to work.
So why don't we go on up to the stage, if you don't mind, and this is also where the screen is located and the fire curtain and so on. For those of you just joining us, this morning show is being recorded in one of the most spectacular spaces you'll ever see here in southeastern Wisconsin, namely the Kenosha Theater, which was a spectacular vaudeville house, movie house, right in downtown Kenosha, closed in the early 1960s. And there are some hardworking volunteers still hoping that one day this spectacular space can be fully restored. So now we're standing right on the main stage. So somewhere here is where the screen would have been. Would the screen have been to the front or the back of the stage?
It would have been about the middle space, actually. So, if you look, there's certainly enough fly space. We don't see any of the stage or the theatrical accoutrements because in 1963, when the building closed, Standard Theaters owned it. They also owned the Gateway Theater, and they had just restored that theater and called it the Lake Theater. Matter of fact, now it's called the Rhodey Opera House. Mm-hmm. And that was a beautiful wrap and wrap were the architects for that. It was a beautiful theater also. It was only a 1,200-seat theater, so really it was like half the seating size. But part of the deal was because Standard Theaters owned both of them, and they sold it. When they sold it, they said that all of the theater seats, all of the theatrical accoutrements had to come out, and it could not be used as a theater for 25 years because they did not want to sell it to a competitor right down the street. So that basically sealed the fate for this building, and it became a warehouse for LeBlanc musical instruments until the late 70s.
So in some ways, this theater was maybe too big for its own good. I mean, was that also what would have hastened its demise and why it was not chosen for restoration at that time?
Well, you have to look at the time. It was closed in 1963 after Hope Lang and Glenn Ford starred in Love is a Ball, April of 1963. But you have to look at the time, too, when television had come around. And its era for the newsreels, and because actually it had a second life during World War II, as the place where people would go to see what was happening overseas, and because of all the newsreels. So, but if you look at television coming along, and the place was just too big, for the dwindling number of theater patrons, because now their entertainment options were Uncle Milty in your living room, So, when you looked at that. So it became, and the live entertainment part had already dwindled. Vaudeville had died years before that, and they had still, granted, in the 40s they would have the big bands on occasion. But it really, all of that had dwindled. So by 1963, the use of this space, was just too big, so that was sealed the fate with a 25-year lease saying that, or deed restriction saying it couldn't be used as a theater. Mm. But it also, because it was on the south end of downtown, as it was shuttered and just became a little a warehouse, it also sort of preserved it because no one really, it was just at the end of downtown, nobody really cared, nobody really paid attention to it. To this day, I still run into people who didn't even know this big monstrous building was here. So.
Right. So in a sense, it was left alone, and in some respects, that was a good thing. I mean, this could have been reshaped into something very contrary to what it was built for, and that would make the process of restoring it even more difficult, I should think.
Exactly. That's what happened to the Rhodey Opera House. The Rhodey Opera House was twinned, and when they do that, plaster be damned. They didn't care about the opulence. It just became these two shoebox theaters. It was more about being able to twin it off and show different movies and make income rather than the opulence of the theater. I still believe, and that's what our theater restoration specialist did, that when you create these spaces again and restore them for live theater, Broadway and music, that this grand space is actually part of the evening. It's, you know, it's part of the character of the evening.
Right. You're entertained from the moment you walk in the door before anyone has sung a note or any drama has unfolded. Ron, let's let you talk for a moment and maybe have you describe what we're seeing as we look out into this space. For instance, what we're seeing towards the sides of the space, what look like side balconies, and then, of course, a really large balcony that maybe we'll travel into in just a moment. But try to describe this space to our listeners.
Right, yeah. Something we haven't mentioned yet is that, this is a movie palace, right? And it's what is known as an atmospheric movie palace. And so when they were building these in the 20s and later, they would build them with kind of stylistic motifs. So this one is built in the style of a Spanish castle, right? So when you're standing on stage, when you look at the walls, you see columns, like Spanish, you know, columns, and plaster that is made to look like stone, right? And then to the right and to the left are these huge columns, with, like you say, with this little balcony underneath them. Behind that is a grate or grates. And what those are, that's where the pipes for the organ were, right? And in the orchestra pit below us was, the original organ was a mighty Wurlitzer, right? So state of the art, and as big as you could get at the time.
I remember, Ron, you mentioned Jeff, you mentioned the other day when we were here that there's only one original light fixture still in this room. Point that out and explain it.
Yeah, it's a crazy little story, but it's one of the aisle lights, and it's still there. And when we were going through and working on trying to get power to it, we would, we were sorting things out, and we flipped on it. We found it and flipped a switch on, and the one light came on, and crazy enough, it came on, and and we haven't had to change that bulb in the entire time. There's something about that particular light bulb. We haven't had to change it in the entire time we've been here, and it's like over 30 years.
Wow. So it's like the spirit of the place still lives. Right. I know that you let me peek into some of the rooms directly behind the stage, which would those have been dressing rooms or rooms?
Yeah, those were dressing rooms. Below stage was 12 dressing rooms, and there was like the one was called a chorus room, so it was a bigger dressing room. And there was actually that on both sides. And then there was another set of 6 dressing rooms behind it. And then there was another all behind backstage were another set of all dressing rooms, pretty much. Behind the two doors over to the left or stage right, that would have been where the load-in. There's actually a loading dock on Fifth Avenue. And there had the little beam with the crane. And there was the actual word, or the actual trap door. And, you know, the word trap door comes from the theater where they would take their trap cases, and everything would move on stage, and then they'd take the cases, and they would open that trap door, and then they would go down the ramp and be stored in a room underneath the stage.
There you go, like magic.
Yeah, like magic.
Maybe we should head up to the balcony and get another perspective of this spectacular room. Again, for those of you just joining us, this is a special edition of the morning show that's being recorded from inside the Kenosha Theater, which is a spectacular movie house that opened in downtown Kenosha in 1927, sadly closing in 1963 as cultural changes made huge, opulent movie houses like this a thing of the past. And of course, across the country, movie theaters like this, not many, but some, have been fully restored very, very successfully. So it is the hope of my two morning show guests that such a restoration might someday occur for the Kenosha Theater. Before we head up the stairs, we're in kind of the lobby area right now. Jeff, you were on board earlier than Ron on this restoration effort. When did that first happen? I mean, when did you become aware of this space and what needed to be done with it?
In 1983 is when we first bought it, and my brother is the one who actually brought it to my attention. I had a recording studio on the third and fourth floor of the Orpheum building, And we were looking for, my brother and I were looking actually for apartment rentals or something, you know, just to try to get into an investment. And he said, one of his friends, his brother owned the theater, Frank Carmichael, actually. Happenings Magazine used to own this. He had theatrical holdings in back then. And we got to take a look at it, and from that moment, when they opened up the side doors, because the electricity wasn't on, they opened up the side doors of the balcony, and the light came in, and I could not believe the place, and thought, and the roof, just like today, the roof was leaking. The roof is leaking. We have leaks in like two places now, but then it was leaking in a few more places, and we looked and said, somebody's got to do something with this. And we walked into the apartment building, and it had been gutted. The windows were pretty much all broken. There was pigeon guano, in mounds of it, and it was everywhere. But we looked at the apartment building, and Frank had started to do some work on the restoration, but as, just things were happening, so he decided, we put an offer in, and so we basically finished up the restoration of the apartments, and that's, we crunched the numbers back then to see that the apartments could pay for the place, could pay for the taxes, could take care of it, but we'd have to get it going pretty fast. So
what drew you to this is actually the relatively nondescript matter of these apartments that you were going to rent, and I'm not saying the theater was an afterthought, but it was not the central matter at hand when you and your brothers became interested in this building. Is that right?
Well, it was the apartment building that got us interested in the building, but then the theater itself, when we first saw it, it all became the apartments were the way that we could save the building. Instead of us just having income property, it became a way that we could maintain and try to save the place. We knew early on that, that there were going to be some hurdles, and there were, and trust me, 30 years out, we still have hurdles. I mean, and when you look at what the estimated cost would be, it's still in this, the economy is not conducive for us to get this restored, at least through the channels that have normally been traditionally the funding mechanisms for getting these things done. So, we still have our hopes, but... not through governmental channels.
Right. So this is the lobby area, and the other day when you gave me the tour, you showed me a wonderful little piece of history from this place. Ron, you want to explain what this board is that's leaning up against one wall?
Yes, we call it the 1927 computer, the version of a computer or of their ticket sales. What it is, it's wood, what is it, maybe 5 feet tall, a foot and a half wide, and basically it has every aisle marked on it, and there's a wooden slot for each seat. So you have the balcony and the main auditorium, and there's a slot for each seat, and what it is the ticket board. So you'd put the tickets in there, the tickets would be in there, and then as you sold them, you would pull them out, and so you could instantly know what's available, what was sold, and people could pick and choose or whatever.
So you would walk in, and before any tickets had been sold, there'd be the end of all of these stubs would be sticking out of all of these slots. And as you chose a seat or a seat was chosen for you, the ticket would just be pulled right out of that slot, and it's ingenious.
Yeah, I mean, who needs a computer, right?
Absolutely. Very good. All right, let's head up the stairs then to the balcony, and maybe as we're making this trip, Jeff, can you explain the kind of work that at the moment is going on, even though you don't have, obviously, the millions of dollars it takes to fully restore? I suspect that all the time, bit by bit, you're trying to do whatever you can to clean up this space. What kinds of things, for instance, at the moment are being done?
Well, at the moment, just as far as the apartments are concerned, over the years we've taken what used to be old 1920s bathtubs and taken that whole space and creating modern bathrooms. That's just in the apartments, because you need to keep the apartment rents at a level to accommodate new taxes or tax increases and insurance and all of that. But as far as the building is concerned, this summer we're looking to do some more tuck pointing. Over the years, we added it up. We've probably done $120,000 worth of tuck pointing to the building already, and we probably got another $60,000 left. You know, that's a small home. You know,
no kidding.
You know, so we still got that to do. And we had a new roof put on. It's been a few years, but we've got a little bit of patching on some of the edges of the roof. We have flashing. We got a little bit of flashing work to do. And then we're basically keeping the place clean. You know, we built like a little storage space for the Ray Shepherdson archives that are in here now, and we're going through that. But what we're looking to do is to take the outer lobby and the inner foyer and this mezzanine area here and try to get an occupancy permit for this area. Hmm. And that's our next goal. You know, it's going to be dealing with starting to get the money together for the restroom restoration, and because if we can just do that and get an occupancy permit and start using this space, even though it's not on the stage, we'll find some places to do some performances and
Absolutely.
Start getting people to see the incredible space.
Right, we could do fundraisers and have performances, and you know that's what make and raise public awareness. And as we're standing here in the mezzanine, I just again every time I come up here, I feel like I'm diving on the Titanic. So just to give your listeners a visual, you have these chandeliers and these columns, and you know, don't you agree? Isn't it amazing?
I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. Columns that have beautiful engraving, and that is still visible to the eye, as is the former beauty of the walls themselves. It's an exquisite space. I mean, even though in a sense we're seeing the ruins of it, still one can get a very clear sense of just how beautiful this once was and how beautiful it still is. And yeah, I could imagine somebody singing a recital in this space, or a string quartet playing, or who knows all the different kinds of things that might happen in this space. So we should go up the stairs up into the balcony, if that's okay, to finish things out. Jeff, I was so glad you mentioned some of these relatively small matters in terms of trying to continue this restoration step by step, because I think some people might hear a price tag of many millions of dollars and imagine that there's no point in trying to contribute to something until there's a really big gift in place that makes all of this within reach. And yet there are smaller steps to be taken, and people can really make a big difference in making those small steps possible.
Oh, sure. You know, I had a futurist, a quote from a futurist that I read the other day. It said, if you don't believe the world can change, that just means you're not one of the people that's going to do it. You know, so and I look at it and I think, you know, so you have to remain optimistic. As I hear water dripping on the stage, that's around the stage, the smoke, the fire retardant thing. But you know, you have to remain optimistic, and doing it in phases has always been an option. And as the potential for government involvement dwindled as the economy over the years has evolved, we started looking at other options in phasing. And, you know, we've still been working on trying to get funding from other sources, looking into the high finance area with people. Somebody asked me one time, well, where were you going to get that kind of money? And I thought, you know, the best place for us to look is let's start asking people who have a lot of money, you know, because there are quite a few of them, you know, and there are foundations and places that you can still, you know, work with. And we've been working with a group for a couple of years, and it's in some cases it seems like herding cats, and it seems like it might not be possible, but at you know, just we feel that it's still a possibility. And you know, when the way that most of these things have been funded historically. My friend Ray Shepherdson, the late Ray Shepherdson, has restored 34 of these theaters. And in most cases, if it wasn't a rich benefactor, it was through revenue bonding through the cities that that helped actually pay the restoration. That's how the Genesee Theater was done in Waukegan. That's how several theaters around the country have been restored. And actually, when you look back at how performing arts centers, you know, civic performing arts centers have been created around the country, they're almost always done through revenue bonds, through bonding. And that's just traditionally how it's done. It's, I read in a, it was an Urban Land Institute book, was talking about the history and how they evolved. And what happened is a city would develop and mature enough and it would reward itself with a performing arts center. It shows a community's maturity into the arts. And, that Kenosha doesn't really have a civic performing arts center, I think is sort of tragic, because we're on track to be the fourth largest city in the state. So, granted, we've got the universities, we've got the Parkside and Carthage University, but we don't have a place, like Milwaukee, where the professional touring acts can come. And the Kenosha Theater is of the right size for that kind of thing to occur, for good, great musical performances. In Aurora, Illinois, the Paramount Theater, they're self-producing just incredible Broadway. And we have spoken with them, and if they said, if you build it, we will come. Mm. And there's critically acclaimed Broadway, and we could try to create a circuit with them. Actually, Tim Rader, who's running that place, has been one of our group of theater, local theater people.
So you've looked at the success stories of other restoration projects and are really trying to learn from those and trying to decide what is the wisest course of action here.
So there are business plans, business models that work. We know they work. It's not like not a mystery. It's just a question of having, the $30 million to refurbish the theater. And to the point of the business plan working, we've partnered with Parkside, the business program out there, and they did a market study a couple of years ago, from their graduate, their business program. So they did a market study of this area, and it indicated that there's a demand, that being the only live performance venue between Milwaukee and Chicago, that there is strong enough demand for national caliber performers that it would work. So it's just a question of so we know it would work. We understand the models and the business plans and how they would work. It's just a question of kind of making it a reality.
Right. If people listening are intrigued by this and feel like they, first of all, want to learn even more, and maybe even join in this effort to try to see the theater restored, what should a listener do?
Actually, I think we have a worldwide web page, but I think our Facebook page is probably more comprehensive, and a lot of people are actually better at using Facebook than they are at the web these days. And you can just contact me through the Facebook page.
And so, what is that Facebook page called?
It's just go Kenosha Theater on Facebook. Just do a search for Kenosha Theater. I think it is facebook.kenoshatheater.com, or kenoshatheater.facebook.com, but it's, if you just type Kenosha Theater, it'll show up, and it has our business. It's the intro to our business plan. It doesn't have the spreadsheets, because that's just, we don't need to get that on the Facebook page. But it has there you'll find the Life magazine photos. You'll find a whole assortment of photography, so you can see what the inside of the building looks like, and you'll also there, like I say, our introduction to our business plan is there, so you'll really get a sense of what we're trying to do.
And I suppose it is worth mentioning as well that we're a nonprofit organization. It's a 501c3, so this is not about Jeff Boss or private owners making a fortune. And there is a 501c3 that exists, that there's a board, and it would be owned and operated by the nonprofit.
It's not one of those things where after 30 years, I think get-rich-quick scheme is certainly not what you would describe this as. This has been a labor of love. Yes. My father was involved with it, and he passed away in 2001. So he never, so 18 years working with his sons every Saturday, we would come and work on the apartments or do whatever we need. So when I look back at that, I have memories of, I've been paid back in some ways already, So I didn't, a lot of people don't get that. I look back at it and because of that, I still believe that we can get it done. Granted, Maybe we can partner with other organizations locally that might have the wherewithal to help. There's Carthage. There's possible venues where we could try to partner. And again, we're still working on trying to get the funding through other sources. It's not like we've ever given up.
Right.
But you just got to have faith and just got to be optimistic. I mean, there's plenty of, you can always say the reasons why you can't do something. Oh, that won't work. And I just won't hear it. I mean, somebody will say, oh, you're crazy. And Ray Shepherdson told me, you're crazy until you do it, and then you're the visionary.
Well, I thank you, gentlemen, for this tour and for this opportunity to once again experience this beautiful space in person. And we hope that people will seek out your Facebook page and learn more about the history of the Kenosha Theater, and not just its history, but we hope a very rich future as well. My thanks to both of you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now to finish out today's morning show, a really special treat. When a colleague of mine at Carthage College in the music department, Judy Kirby, noticed in the schedule that I was going to be airing an interview about the Kenosha Theater, she sent me an email and told me that her own father, Al Milkey, had been an usher at the Kenosha Theater back when he was in high school. And I thought it would be so fun to connect with him and to find out a little bit about what the Kenosha Theater looked like in its heyday from somebody who was there a lot as one of its employees and saw it in its full beauty. So via the telephone from where he lives in Wautoma, Al Milkey, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Nice to be here.
I'm so glad to be talking to you. So first of all, can you tell us the years that you were in high school and so the years that you served as an usher at the old Kenosha Theater?
Graduated in 1948. So I probably worked the first couple of years, would be like 47, 46. I was probably 16 years old, I think, about that time. Most of the ushers were, and the young people that worked there were probably in that age group, all high school people. So it was a nice job for a young person. There isn't a lot of things that a young person at that age could do as far as finding employment, but so it was... It was a nice piece of work for us.
I've seen some photographs of ushers from way back when.
Oh.
The photographs I have seen all show ushers to be dressed up in fairly formal-looking uniforms. Tell us what you wore.
Well, it's nice. Remember, that was 75 years ago. I'm trying to remember now. The jackets were blue. I think we were mostly blue. Probably some striping for the slacks and so on. The women, the girls that worked at the counter, the popcorn people and so on, were just dressed in white, almost like surgical looking.
Hmm.
But the rest of us were in blue uniforms. It's interesting. One of the young men that I worked with, and the name is probably familiar to you and probably to your listeners. Alan Amici worked for us.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you talk about uniforms. We had to order a special uniform for him because he didn't fit anything else.
He was a big guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. So as usher...
With him. All of us got along very, very well.
Mm.
We generally would go out afterwards, after work, and maybe at one of the restaurants, one of the lunch places, So we spent a lot of time together, both at work and afterwards as well.
So what exactly was the work that you did as an usher? I mean, what exactly were you and your colleagues doing with the patrons coming to the movies?
Seating people. The aisles, as I remember, if I'm not mistaken about this, the aisles, at the end of the aisles, there were small illuminations so that you could see the aisle, but the rest of the course, the theater was dark. And the usher would carry flashlights and lead people to vacant seats in the theater, both on the main floor and also in the balcony. There's a large balcony. If you've toured the place, you've probably seen part of that area, I would think.
Absolutely.
There was a large foyer lobby on the first floor as well as on the second floor leading up to the balconies. There was a large open area there as well.
Hmm.
And so that's pretty much the way we conduct that. That's the main responsibility that ushers had was seating people, and also at times when there were intermissions, make sure that people were in the proper smoking areas and so on.
Right. So you were ushering people to specific seats? Would people buy tickets that were assigned to very specific seats?
Oh, no. Seating was not assigned. You simply, because of the darkness of theater, we became accustomed to the darkness, that you could see pretty well where there were vacancies in the various aisles and seating areas. So if a pair of two people came in or four people came in, you would remember the layout of the seating area and direct people to vacant seats.
One of the things I was told is that a lot of the entertainment that occurred at the Kenosha Theater, especially back in its heyday, would be a mixture of movies that would be shown on the screen with live entertainment. Although, as time went on, that live entertainment aspect started to go away with the fading of vaudeville. By the time you were ushering there, was it basically just a movie house?
Oh, no. We had a number of, at that time, were famous entertainers. I worked with people like Duke Ellington and Nat King Cole and Claude Thornhill, W.S. Barndance, Tiny Hill. Did I mention Nat King Cole? I did, I guess. A number of live, Bela Lugosi, the old vampire actor, made an appearance at one of our Halloween programs. The Halloween shows would usually take place at midnight, of course, and so he would came in. Three Stooges appeared there at the theater at one point in time. Worked with them.
Mm.
Esther Williams came in and appeared once during one of her movies. I guess she came in and made a personal appearance.
Wow.
Those are the names that come to mind immediately. The ones that I remember very clearly.
And say a word about what the Kenosha Theater inside looked like back in its heyday. I mean, at the time, did it seem like a spectacular looking place to you?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was magnificent. Very colorful, very, how should I describe it? Yeah, high ceilings and nice, brilliant illumination in the features of the ceiling and the sidewalls. There were all those areas that looked like there were, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Small areas where seating on the sides, they were actually there, but it appeared as if it were. Seating areas on up above, balcony type seating, as best as I can remember, that's the best way to describe it, I guess.
Hmm. A spectacular looking place, and of course, there are people hoping to someday restore it to its former beauty. And it's,
I hope they can.
Yeah, it's neat to speak with someone who actually was there, Al Mielke, who was an usher at the Kenosha Theater once upon a time. Al, thank you so much for your time. It was great to speak with you.
Nice talking with you. Glad you called.
Coming up on Monday's morning show, a conversation with Marina Cantacuzino. She is the creator of something called The Forgiveness Project and the author of a book of the same name, The Forgiveness Project, Stories for a Vengeful Age. The book is designed to help all of us think a little bit more about what it means to forgive someone else. On Tuesday, we're going to introduce you to three very talented Kenoshans who just graduated from high school, Joey Bellotti, Michael Aiello, and Chuck Aiello, and maybe you know them as The Bugs, a wonderful music group who are about to release a new recording. On Wednesday, we'll spend part of the hour with Courtney Grieve, a horticulture instructor here at Gateway Technical College, talking about Gateway's upcoming plant sale. Also a conversation with the editor of a wonderful book called It All Changed in an Instant, a collection of six-word memoirs. On Thursday, President Brian Albrecht from Gateway Technical College. A week from today, local author Carol Burrow-Gianforte, author of a wonderful new memoir called My Heart Leads Me Home, a daughter's memoir. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Variable cloudiness today. Our skies are expected to become increasingly cloudy, with a pretty good chance of showers and thunderstorms later on, a high today of 80 degrees. Tonight, more showers and thunderstorms, a low of 55 degrees, a 60% chance of rain tomorrow, and much cooler, a high tomorrow of just 58 degrees. It will gradually warm up next week. This is WGTDHD.